It is Saturday, December 12th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news in the first half. In the second half, we're going to talk about confirmation bias.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. So please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. It's a love-hate relationship. Love your cars and hate it when they break. You'll love the car guys and hate to miss them when Click and Clack give their advice on all things automotive every Saturday, right after Geek Speak at 11 a.m. and right here on Central Coast Public Radio KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxel. In the Arum with me are geeks. Miles Elam, he's a student, slacker, and political junkie. Actually, Miles, you're no longer a student.
Nope, I am no longer a student.
You actually have your bachelor's of arts in literature?
They haven't mailed it to me yet, but...
But it's just a matter of time.
Unless some professor goes beyond the pale in grading my last papers hypercritically, I have graduated.
What was that statistic that you told me about? Lyle, about Miles.
I think this is what it is. Miles got out of high school, went to college for a couple of years. When he started college, the freshman year of college, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were born, as people are born every year.
Mm-hmm.
He then took a hiatus from university for a while, and then last year he started university again. The end of this quarter, those people will graduate.
Next fall.
Well, the students that were born the year he started college
will become freshmen
in college. So it took him the length of a child.
I was on the 17-year plan.
Yeah. Wow.
We also have, as you can tell, Al Leckow. Al Leckow is a new media architect. Morning, Al.
Hello, everybody.
And via Skype, we have Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a freelance media guy living in Berkeley, hence not always being here. Morning, Ben.
Morning.
And we also have our guest, Dom Massaro. Dominic Massaro is professor of psychology and computer engineering at UCSC. And Dom, we're going to speak with you about confirmation bias in the second half. If you'd like to join us in the news and everything, please feel free to do so. And welcome, Dom.
Great. Thank you. Looking forward to it.
So starting out the news today, I think we'll go ahead and jump over to Mr. Miles Elam. There's no way to say it. It's like Master Miles or anything.
No, like I have a bachelor's degree like so many other people.
You're one up on me, man. Go on.
Miles Elam, B.A.
Yes, Miles Elam, B.A.
Yes. Anyway, so British researcher Adrian Furham, he's a professor of psychology at the University College London, was doing some research on intelligence, specifically intelligence with regard to men and women. And whether there were any differences and the like, trying to avoid any confirmation bias and actually get some data. And what they found was quite striking, that men and women are fairly equal overall in terms of IQ. That's not the striking part. The striking part is that, I guess maybe to many women it wouldn't seem striking, that men believe themselves to be smarter than they actually were.
No.
On the flip side, what they were finding among women was that they believed themselves to be less intelligent than they actually were.
Okay, how did they do this study? Did they do like an IQ test?
I'd have to go back to the methodology. But,
okay.
Maybe there are more men from Lake Wobegon.
Yeah.
So, above average.
That's right. Above average.
The Norwegians.
But another interesting thing that was found was when asked for example, when they ask both men and women about different generations, like, which do you think was smarter, your mother or your father? So asking about others as well, not just assessing your own intelligence. Both sexes said that the father was smarter than the mom, or that the son was smarter than the daughter.
Wow. Hmm. Sad. Why is it happening?
Well, that was happening. That he's saying a long time ago, people perceived that. I mean, that was what parents made you realize was that dad's smart, mom isn't. You know, and nowadays,
so you're saying
that's
that it's social
notion. Yeah.
How are you sure that that is correct and that's not just confirmation bias based upon your...
You know what? I'd have to ask my wife. She's a smart one.
That's true.
There is literature, however, that points to the fact if you stress race or sex, for example, you can push that stereotype and you can get the result that you're saying.
You mean as you ask the question, depending on how you structure the study?
Yeah. So if you focus on that dimension, and if you bring people away from that dimension, then they can be more confident.
Yeah, we covered that with some tests a while back, that if researchers, for example, giving a math test and they're trying to find differences there, if they told women in the group, we want to see why this is happening, there's this discrepancy, the discrepancy appeared. But if they didn't mention anything...
It didn't show, right. Yeah, studies are tricky. Well, we'll get into more of that soon. Other things that are tricky is aliens in Norway. Ben, what's going on? Why are we being invaded?
Well, for a while, everyone was really excited because, oh my gosh, something weird happened in the sky, so we must have evidence of aliens, right? I mean, this is a story you see over and over again, and unfortunately, these astronomers people and rocket scientists people keep, raining on a parade. But anyway, so...
You mean reality seems to come in at one point? And so what was that
reality
thing?
What's this thing? Anyway, so yeah, either that or there was a glitch in the Matrix or something, but check out the video because this thing was weird. Basically, people observed a blue light that kind of seemed to soar up from behind a mountain, and it stopped midair and started to circulate, and it created a giant spiral that covered, and they say covered the sky. It didn't cover the sky. It was a pretty large portion of the sky.
Like a twirling spiral?
Well, I would imagine it depends on how close you were.
Actually not really, because it was really, really high up in the atmosphere. There was no atmospheric drag, so it wasn't moving.
And so a lot of people saw it.
But a lot of people saw it, yeah. Pretty much anyone in Norway could... there are tons of videos from all these different vantage points. But anyway, so yeah, this giant spiral, you know, the kind of one that you see in the spiral glasses, that kind of thing.
You know what? Impressive. I have one of those spirals in my toilet.
Oh, that's called a flush, yeah.
Yeah, it spirals. It's very mysterious.
Yeah.
I don't really quite get it, but it always goes the same direction.
Oh, I'm so going to... I can't help it. It's the shape of your bowl, dude. It has nothing to do with Coriolis effect.
Oh, that's what it is.
Miles, you're going to mention the Coriolis effect and that it doesn't actually take effect at that small scale, and then we're not going to get into that. We're going to go on. Okay, so the really cool spiral, there's a picture on the website, and we've talked about whether water goes down in one direction or not in different hemispheres on different shows, and we'll do it again, I'm sure. But
right, and the Russian rocket was not subject to the Coriolis effect.
Hey, I haven't said it was a Russian rocket yet.
Hey, you're giving everything away.
Now, hold on. So all these people thought it was an alien, but turned out, anyone guess what it was?
A Russian rocket.
Yeah.
How did the aliens get the Russian rocket, though?
I know, exactly. How'd they make it do that cool thing?
Yeah.
That's really the million-dollar question.
Right.
So its theory is to be a Russian Proton M carrier rocket. They've got this picture of it looking very innocuous on the launch pad. It looks not nearly as innocuous when it's creating a big spiral in the sky.
So basically it had some kind of leak or something?
Exactly. This is what they think happened, is a leak came out from the side, which caused the rocket to spiral, and the stuff that was being ejected was just being ejected straight out, right? But because it was rotating, it looked like, from further away when you couldn't see the actual material itself, it looked like a spiral effect. And so that's what caused it.
Of course, the Russians must have denied it. No, it wasn't us.
Well, at first they did. At first they did deny it. And then eventually they were like, oh, yeah, guys, it was a failed launch. And it's kind of sad because they keep failing at these launches. But in any case, so this was definitely the most interesting failed uh, failed launch.
All right. Well, thank you.
Excellent. Now, the
you
fact
should
that
check out the video, because when the spiral stops, it just stops completely, like, just dead stops. And so you get this expanding disk of darkness that kind of envelops the – it was really, really cool video. I'll put it up on the site in a couple of minutes.
Right. Now, the belief that it was aliens was not confirmation bias. However, it's eluding me what the logical fallacy is, the name of it. If anyone could call in with that one, that'd be awesome.
Mass hysteria or mass illusion. Or
yeah. Let's go ahead and go to Al's first story. You were playing with live video?
Yeah. Last week I talked about an iPhone app that you could, you know, connect with other iPhone users and have live video back and forth. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get to work, but I'm still, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt, the Oprah effect, you know, lots of people trying it. So, but then I'm noticing that Apple is sort of opening the floodgates on allowing live videos on apps. And there's another one called Ustream, and it's another free app, and mm-hmm. it supposedly allows you to view live video, you know, to another person on a phone or a website or whatever. And so I was researching it, and as I went, I found their website. It's a Ustream website, and it's just filled with like all these videos of people. It's all live videos,
right?
And so basically, it's somebody that has a video right on them, and they're just staring at it. And then there's like a
webcams, basically.
Yeah, it's like a webcam. And then there's like a list of chatting things, and you can like talk to them, and then they talk live back to you.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, this is, you know, sort of like the whole porn kind of thing.
Right.
But it's not. I mean, this is, you know, this is sort of more
and
of a social thing.
And you're doing this through your phone?
You can supposedly do it through your phone. I did it through the web because I was researching it. But as I went and did it, I started realizing, you know, some people have like 77 people watching them. Other people have like one person. And
The people that have 77, what are they doing?
Usually it's nothing. They're just standing there or they're talking and they're just talking. It's like somebody, you know, saying stuff. One of them, I went in and there was like nobody in there. And it was a bunch of guys sitting around in Cleveland at night, all drinking, all laughing and stuff. And I just type in, hey. And then I hear one of the guys goes, hey, somebody's typing to us. You know, and they all come around and they all start talking to me and playing their music. And I'm like, this is strangely like compelling. It's really kind of creepy in a way because they don't know who you are and you're just typing. And it's just weird. And you can see them. But it's kind of like the social phenomenon of, you know, the text going back and forth. But now you're like looking at the video and typing. It's this sort of mishmash of you know, combination of technology.
And that's Ustream, and Ustream's been around for quite a while.
Yeah. It's really weird.
It's a fun thing to play with, though.
Yeah, you go in there one night, and I guarantee you'll trip out a little bit. just wow, this is weird. You know, and a lot of the people are, you know, younger, and I'm just seeing this whole phenomenon of all, you know, all these people. You
broadcast
know.
Yourself all the time,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much for that. Miles, hi. It's your turn. How's it going?
Hiya.
Miles, you're wearing a fish hat. Okay, go on.
He's trying to keep warm.
So biofuels have hit the news a lot. Use of algae, for example, as a way to generate enough biodiesel, for example, to drive cars. It was one way that doesn't compete with crop fuels. For example, trying to grow corn in order to make an ethanol-based mm-hmm. fuel, that type of thing. One of the problems, though, has always been that when you have the algae or the bacteria or the like making this material, even though a very large part of their bodies ends up being an oil that you can use as a base for it, the problem is it's encased in the body of the organism. So how do you get it out? And it's been fairly expensive and a lot mm-hmm. of work. Well, some researchers at the Arizona State University have been working on a self-destructing bacteria, a bacteria that they did some gene splicing and inserted a gene into the bacteria's genome so that it actually starts to dissolve from the inside out so that at the end of its life cycle, you end up with this goop that doesn't have a bacterial sheath around it.
Just a pile of oil.
So is that easier to access then?
Exactly. You don't have to go through that extra step of trying to get the fatty...
Yeah.
You
don't have to separate
the
as
inside.
Much.
Yeah, you just...
I think I've seen a ray gun that did that in a science fiction movie.
Just a big group of pile.
People just turn into like a pile of liquid.
How does the cellulose material disappear? Like it transforms that as the last stage?
Well, for bacteria, itself, it wouldn't be cellulose,
okay,
per se. Although I guess it could be. It's because you are talking about pond scum, so I guess it might have...
Something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not a biologist.
But in general, it's How would you do it?
I don't understand. Does the organism actually convert that as well as the last stage? Does it convert itself into oil?
Yes.
That's creepy.
It's the bacteria itself that basically it grows, it does its thing, and then it
turns inside out and poof, all oil. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Basically.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Mr. Jaffe, let's talk about your favorite celestial body, shall we?
Yeah, a while ago, you guys were giving me, this was like 6 months ago, you guys were giving me flack for mentioning Iapetus randomly. It's a moon of Saturn, and I just kind of like saying the name and talking about it. It's a really, really bizarre moon. It's shaped like a walnut because it's got this mountain range that goes all the way around. But anyway, so I've been waiting for this moment. There's actually a news story on Iapetus.
So you get to say it again. Right? Yeah, definitely.
So there's this new model that's been created. It's based on visible and infrared data from the Cassini space mission, which we've heard a lot about, tons of data coming out of that. So there's a bit of a story to this. Basically, Iapetus is very, very red on one side and not red on the other. And we've been trying to figure out exactly why this is.
It happens to me a lot in the summer at the beach.
Iapetus is tidally locked with Saturn, so that means that one of the sides of Iapetus is always facing Saturn. It's kind of like our moon. We only see one side of it, right? The other thing is Saturn has reddish dust floating around it in orbit. And so Iapetus orbits through this dust. One way you can think of it is that one side of Iapetus is always facing into the dust and the other side is not. And so over 2.4 billion years, this makes Iapetus very red on one side and the other side, it's not very red at all. It's more white.
Its natural color.
The ice.
Yeah. And this red dust, where is it coming from?
Presumably from Saturn. I'm not positive on that. I don't think we are either.
Okay. So that's been a mystery for a while, why that was colored that way.
That itself has not been a mystery.
Oh, okay.
It's been a theory, but the strange thing is that Iapetus has kind of slightly strange patterns, right? It's this really wide band across the moon. And not so much at the poles. And so we've been trying to figure out why is this and trying to create a model based on this. And so we actually have looked at this data and figured out that the when it gets red, it gets warmer because the red dust absorbs heat.
Okay.
And so as a result, some ice evaporates and travels to the colder regions of the planets, being the poles or the other side. And then it's becomes ice again, and it falls onto the planet and covers it. And so that's the new model, and I think it's pretty cool.
It's pure white on one side because all the ice is over there. It's been evaporated from one side to the other. Why? What about the bulge? Do we know about the walnut-y kind of bulge in the middle?
It's just a mountain range. I mean,
we don't really know how that's structured.
Yeah, a couple very silly people theorize that it's actually the mold created from when aliens created Iapetus out of a mold.
Well, that makes sense.
That's the seam. I don't think that's a very compelling argument.
The planet really does look like a walnut. It's kind of like that shape. Does, if you look at it, it has a giant bulge of mountain in the center.
Moon.
And then a moon. And then on one side of it's like really very red, and the other side is very white, which it's strange to have that kind of thing. And that's because it doesn't – okay, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Now, the coolest thing about this is that they applied this model and they did the calculations over 2.4 billion years in this model. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the model that they theorized looks very, very similar to Iapetus. And you
amazing
can actually
how that
see
works.
It in the link that I just posted to the GeekSpeak website.
So they confirmed their idea.
Yes. They. That's how science works, right?
They had a bias and they confirmed it. All right.
The other news is I'm really excited that I finally got to talk about Iapetus legitimately on GeekSpeak.
Yeah, but of course you mentioning that it now is legitimate emphasizes the lack of legitimacy last few times you mentioned it.
Oh, yeah.
I still love you, Ben. All right, let's go on to Al. What's Amazon doing lately?
Amazon has instigated a pay phrase. They've just opened up the ability to use a pay phrase.
What is a pay phrase?
A pay phrase, what they do is, you know how you can go in Amazon and do the one-click paying and all that kind of stuff?
Yes.
Well, they're making it now so that you can pay with a phrase. And so you set up your account and you type in all your information and then you come up with a phrase and then you add a pin to it. And then any place you are that accepts Amazon payments, you just type in this phrase and this pin and you're done. and you don't have to do anything. So it's not like you're using it's secure, and you're actually going through their secure servers. So you're going and
so, so does that mean that I could set up a pay phrase that was like, Lyle is totally awesome, and then I could say, hey, go buy something, and I could give that to you, and it would actually be billed on my account if you were able to say that phrase?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's a new thing. It's you know, I don't know. It's just one of those situations where you wonder how secure this kind of thing is.
Sure.
Because, but you know, they do have a pin with it. I mean, it's and it's kind of neat. And a lot of the pay phrases are weird. I mean, it doesn't have to be an actual phrase, but it can be something you remember. So then right. Once you've set this up, you just remember. You
it's
know,
it's just a password. It just happens to be a very long one. But
right.
See, the thing with phrases like that is they have to kind of test to make sure that they're not common phrases. For example, you know, give me the money at some point. That
well,
phrase
then it has
been,
a pin with it.
Yeah, I guess
so. And the idea is you can go to these websites and just type, you know, it'll say pay with pay phrase. And you click that, you just type those two things and you're done. And then you leave.
I see.
And Amazon's just opening this up as their new big deal.
So, but if you and I happen to have the same phrase, we have different pins, is it going to work?
Yes.
Huh. Yep. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you, Al, for that. We have time for one more, Miles.
Okay. So a question has been posed by a gentleman by the name of Benoit Felton.
Benoit?
Because he's an analyst in Paris, so I'm assuming that's a French pronunciation.
How do you spell that? Does it look like Benoit?
B-E-N-O-I-T. Benoit.
Okay. Benoit.
He's a little skeptical of the concept of the bandwidth hog. We've heard a lot about it, ISPs talking about it, especially Comcast, AT&T talking about there are a few users that are sucking up a huge amount of the pipe, and right. It's degrading the experience for the other users.
Hence all the stuff with BitTorrent being shut down by Comcast for a while and such.
Right.
Okay.
Now, one thing that Felton is taking issue with is the fact that TCP/IP, by its design, would limit the ability of a bandwidth hog to monopolize the to take down the network by using up all the space. Now, when, for example, if you're at home and you have BitTorrent running,
mm-hmm. File sharing
or,
system.
Yeah, for example, yeah, file sharing going on, or rather a family member does, because
mm-hmm.
Of course it wouldn't be you.
Never.
Could be.
Getting some music.
There's legitimate uses of BitTorrent.
That's true.
I download every version of every Linux OS, so yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually so busy.
Yeah.
Okay, so So someone else is downloading something, you're downloading something, and I'm in your house, and I'm trying to look at the web, and suddenly everything is very, very slow.
Why is that?
But that's not necessarily because of TCP/IP. It's not because of our network. It's largely due to the fact that we have an asynchronous connection to, or not an asynchronous.
The DSL.
An asymmetric connection to the internet. The upload rate is much slower than the download rate. So if you're taking up the upload rate, you can't download as much because that communication has to go back and forth. For every kilobyte you get down, you're putting in a few bytes up to say, like, yes, I got this packet. Yes, I got this. If you saturate your uplink, your downlink doesn't go. But
so what you're basically saying is that if you saturate your uplink, your downlink matches that speed.
Wow, that's really interesting because your upload speed is always much slower. My upload speed is like 2 meg and my download is like 20 meg.
Right.
And so I'm used to getting things fast, but then if I'm uploading, then it's going to totally mess up my download speed.
A lot of times it will, yes.
Yeah.
But that's not the scenario it's coming across. I'm just pausing this as, you know, through my own personal confirmation bias, that this is why it's easy to sell people the idea of the bandwidth hog, because
right.
We see this in our own homes.
Yes, right. It makes mm-hmm. sense. You see Granny looking at her porn, and then you go, wait, I don't have good internet, so if other people in the world are doing that, then that's why. My neighbors are messing up my internet.
Right.
Okay.
But an ISP is not necessarily constrained by those same constraints that your DSL line
right.
is. And TCP/IP will actually take care of a lot of those issues of making sure that everyone has their fair share.
Mm-hmm.
That if, you know, one person was sucking up a huge amount of bandwidth to begin with, and then 99 other people tried to come on to help, it's going to throttle back that one person.
Right.
Back
it's going
to
share
a level.
It amongst everybody. So why are people, why are companies marketing it as a bandwidth hog, a neighborhood bandwidth hog?
Well, the theory brought forth by Felton is that they're just selecting the top 5% of users and then saying these are the bandwidth hogs that are causing all sorts of problems. That way, they can reduce their costs with regard to infrastructure.
The truth is they do. Because the truth is the ISP actually does pay for the amount of bandwidth that customers use.
Right.
And therefore,
they are
using
a lot more
than
the average.
Yeah. They take the high ones and go, wait, these are affecting all the customers. All the customers are like, yeah, don't affect us.
No,
it's not. So they get support. No, what I'm saying is, if the ISP promotes it as we're going to make a better internet for you, then everybody will support their decision to ban or reduce people's load.
Right.
Even though that's not the truth.
Right. So this analyst was actually asking for, hey, ISPs,
show me some statistics.
Show me some logs. Show me
the stats.
Right. And we'll be able to look at this. However, there are a lot of folks who are not expecting them to deliver their logs anytime soon.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Miles Elam. Hey, I want to let you know that GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Complete Mailing Service, located in the Harvey West Business Park. Complete Mailing Service, pushing the envelope for Santa Cruz County since 1976. Complete Mailing Service at 425-5556. You're listening to GeekSpeak, and my name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Miles Elam and Al Luckow. And over the Skype connection from Berkeley, California, we have Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben, you still with us?
I am.
How wonderful.
What was that moon name again?
Iapetus. Huh. It's so cool.
I need a podcast of the week. Who wants to recommend a good podcast? I'll do it. Nice cricket sound. That was good.
I've been working on that one.
You should be a Foley. Yeah. Let's do it again. And you can listen to great sound effects from Al Luckow.
Yeah, podcast. There's just one.
Okay, we'll just promote this then. Last week, I threw up a camera that was doing an interval shooting. Every 5 seconds, would take a picture of us on the parade truck, right? So that raw images, thousands of them. How many photos did we get?
There were thousands.
Thousands of them. I put them on a CD, threw them off to Al. Al's a little media guy. He's a media specialist. What is it again?
I can't remember.
New media architect.
Cricket impersonator.
And so he made a great video of our GeekSpeak episode from last week. We had some trouble with NPR podcasting syncs. They had some systems mess up. So it's very possible, if you're listening to this via podcast, that you didn't get last week's show, make sure to get it. And relatively soon up on the website, we'll have the video of that. If you're part of our Facebook community, you can see Al's post.
And also the horsehair worm that I found in my yard.
Which is creepy and freaky.
A very weird worm that they're out now. My friend Michael was at my house. He found it, showed it to my wife. My wife got me. It's like a foot long. It's like a big brown strand of spaghetti. It's the weirdest looking worm you'll ever see.
We have to submit that to the Facebook GeekSpeak page so people Very can see strange. It that aren't actually friends of yours. All right. Dominic Massaro is a professor of psychology and computer engineering at UCSC. Dom and I work together launching the MFA program that I currently work at, Digital Arts New Media Masters of Fine Arts program. And Professor Massaro studies perception and language. Dom is well known for Baldi, a software application that perfectly models human speech. It models the human head and how the tongue moves, and it can go transparent and you can see the mouth structure. So for someone who doesn't hear very well, if they want to emulate sounds, it's a really wonderful tool for that. And recently you launched Baldi on the iPhone.
Right.
So you can pick
Thanks
that up.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, certainly. Very cool app. And we're going to be talking about confirmation bias. So can you give us just the general definition of what confirmation bias is, Don?
Sure. I'd be interested also to know how the geeks settled on the confirmation bias. But over four centuries ago, the English philosopher Francis Bacon wrote that biased assessment of evidence drove all superstitions, whether in astrology, dreams, omens, divine judgments, or the like. So today we have similar false icons, like the belief in the paranormal, UFOs, the mystery spot, and even this spiral over Norway. So it's basically a biased assessment of evidence.
And Bacon's great. Didn't Bacon invent gunpowder?
He did a lot of things.
Yeah, he's an amazing, amazing guy.
Well, the European...
Yes, of course.
Transmission of a Chinese concept.
So in layman's terms now... The description of it is kind of, if you have an idea of what reality is, you will pay attention to things that support your idea and kind of ignore things that don't support your idea.
Exactly. So we have certain beliefs and we seek out evidence that supports those beliefs and ignore evidence that disagrees with it.
And this is time and a time is shown in studies.
Over and over again, yes. Psychologists make a living out of doing this. Many of them do, yes.
So can you explain another study and like an example of seeing this in the wild?
Well, or specific instances in history,
sure.
too. So, for example, we all know, right, that bees communicate the source and location of food to other bees. Right,
right, by dancing.
By dancing, right. They do this incredible waggle. They come back to the hive, do this incredible waggle that is actually correlated with the distance and the direction of the food source.
Right.
And Carl von Frisch got a Nobel Prize for discovering this. And then scientists continued to support this idea over and over and over again. But in fact, all of them were operating with a confirmation bias in the way they set up the experiments. For example, something simple like putting the food source in the middle relative to all the other non-food sources and say, oh, the bees go to the food source. Or not realizing that the bees took 20 minutes to get to the food source. And so, you know, if they were given the message directly, why did it take 20 minutes as opposed to flying upwind and getting smell and helping locate the source of food? So this is still an incredible controversy in biology, whether bees indeed are able to transmit this information. But what's so exciting about it is that the research that was done with this confirmation bias. And then about 20 or 30 years ago, some researchers in California realized this idea that they were operating with a confirmation bias. So they immediately started doing these experiments without a bias, and sure enough, they couldn't find any evidence for it. And what was interesting about this, and again, reveals science, is that they were completely ostracized from the community. They could no longer get grants. They weren't invited to conferences,
really?
And so on.
Hmm.
So,
even though their study was valid and they posted it in peer-reviewed magazines?
And the way the scientists that had the bias responded to it was to go out and do another study to show that, yes, we had it, exactly.
Well, why is that? Why is bad science happening? That's bad science, isn't it?
I mean, because it's people that do science.
And
that's why. And so I run up against this all the time. There was just a Nature article that revealed that people can perceive speech via ear puffs on their neck. And again, it was completely fallacious, you know. And I wrote a letter to Nature criticizing this, and they wrote back and said, no, we're not going to publish your letter. You need to have hard data on this. But they published this.
They published this
finding
other data.
Without hard data, yeah. So
wow.
It's an interesting experience. But we're all susceptible to this because we're all humans. And what leads to it? You know, one thing, like for the common person, we give too much evidence to our personal experience. We take that as valid.
Right.
Our memories, our personal experience. And in fact, we know, again, from psychological studies that this can mislead people, that in many times experience is fallacious.
Did you ever read that book, The Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz?
No, but I've heard about it.
Yeah. It's a great book.
Yeah, like when one of my colleagues said, I asked him, have you read this book? Read it. I haven't even lectured on it yet.
Well, lecture on that. But you actually do, you know a lot about choice and how people make decisions, right? That's part of your field of study.
That's right, yes.
So do we make decisions that, well, okay, so I recall, I'm trying to get more examples of confirmation bias because it is a kind of a hard thing to grasp. And when you notice it in yourself, you go, it's kind of like that ah moment where if you think a certain thing, like for example, you know, we were talking about the toilet earlier and the Coriolis effect. And that, you know, there's this idea that water spirals a certain way in the northern hemisphere versus the southern hemisphere. And that is true in large weather systems. Almost always the weather systems rotate a certain direction depending on the atmosphere, depending on the
regard to hurricanes in the northern versus southern.
And that has to do with the Earth rotating and it's a sphere and that the ground is traveling faster at the equator than closer to the poles because it's more area to come across. And because of that, the winds that are produced almost always kind of move the direction of the Earth rotation faster, closer to the equator. And so in the northern equator, you get them spinning one direction. In the southern, below the southern equator, you get them spinning the other direction. That idea makes a lot of sense. It's fine. And then people go, well, therefore, anything that spins would do that. And they'll look at a sink and they'll, you know, drain the sink. And if you do it, sometimes it'll go one direction, sometimes it'll go another because the distance is just not that big. It doesn't really matter over small distances like that. There's not much curve of the Earth. But if you ever have a conversation with somebody about it, they go, no, I've seen this. I've seen this over and over again. It's like, yeah, you have. But reality, every time you see it, it might have been a 50-50 thing. Toilets always go because the way the jets are. But
there's also the way it's presented. For example, near the equator, whether you're in South America, whether you're in Africa or Asia, you'll see the same thing where you'll have a bunch of people saying, hey, check this out. I have this bowl of water here, and you know, I put down this drain on this side of the equator, and the equator's right here, and they draw some line in the sand, you know, step across and do the same experiment. Hey, look, it goes the other way. And really, it's because they poured the water in a slightly different angle.
Yeah, right.
So when you were talking earlier about the water goes a different way depending on how it'll go a different way each time, it's actually not true. It's the shape of the bowl
of the toilet
will dominate greatly.
So this
that's interesting.
Here's an example of confirmation bias. If you go and buy a piece of clothing, then you might tend to look for the same clothing in a more expensive store and then confirm that you've bought a bargain, whereas you wouldn't do it the other way. You wouldn't go to a cheaper a flea market and look for the same piece of clothing because then you'd feel bad about your purchase. That's a nice example.
Yeah. So, as Lyle was saying, we remember the positive instances. And so, for example, gee, I had this dream about a friend I hadn't heard about from for a long time, and gee, he called me the next morning. But we don't remember all the times we had dreams about somebody that they didn't call the next morning.
Oh, I see.
So those positive instances are much more salient than the negative ones.
It seems like this kind of thing would be the type of science that would come into play when you're dealing with, criminal victims and things like that. And, you know, they're having to describe a scene and, you know, the more they describe it, the more it changes. Or you were there when the mugger came in. Well, you know, he was the mugger, I guess. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like, it seems like this kind of science would really apply because I know that there's a lot of inaccuracies when victims are
in memory.
You know, have their memory. You know, they just can't. You know, they're being led to believe something when it didn't really happen. And all the people who have the I don't want to. I don't have so much time for email.
Yeah, and all of this leads to a very very important theme, which is the scientific method. The purpose of it isn't to have Bunsen burners and beakers and have people have an excuse to wear white lab coats. It's the idea that human beings have bias, whether it's this confirmation bias, whether it's because they have an inability to see, you know, certain colors, so they just assume they're not there, or you know, things like that. So you just gather data and then look at the data and see what happens, even though it may come to a conclusion that's contrary to your expectations.
And you can kind of think of the scientific method of study as a way to try to set up systems so that you reduce the amount of impact that your own bias and own decisions have in your figuring out what reality is. So basically, the method is really to stop people from creating a reality and actually figuring out what reality is. That's the kind of method of it. Dom, do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, Chamberlain wrote an article in Science over 100 years ago about the scientists should approach a problem with multiple working hypotheses. You don't want to have just one hypothesis that you're seeking out evidence to confirm, but you need two or more that you're contrasting. So data are meaningless, really, without theory. And what you need to have are opposing theories so that your data then can discriminate between those theories.
Yeah, I would imagine also falsifiability.
That's right.
The ability
That's
to right. determine
so
whether or not
you have opposing
your theory
theories,
is
one,
hypothesis
one should
is right.
be falsifiable. That's right. And Karl Popper, the philosopher of this century, argued for falsification in scientific inquiry.
So then you teach a class at UCSC, this is your focus of teaching the scientific method? Or are you helping people identify these flaws? Are you saying these are the things we should be doing? Or how exactly do you approach getting this sort of idea out and communicating it with
With scientists?
Yeah, yeah. It's hard. And also for students. So trying to give students to wear a critical thinking hat, like De Bono, the British psychologist, you can wear these different hats. And one is to be a skeptic. And if you're a skeptic, you don't have a lot of friends, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, in Santa Cruz, all good for you, you know, you're doing that, you know. But right. but so we don't question others' behaviors and beliefs and so on. So this skepticism is something we should all have that promotes good inquiry, gets us down the path of truth, beauty, and wisdom.
Can you teach that?
Exactly.
Can you teach good skepticism?
Well, as I can teach specific how to overcome specific fallacies, and the students do well on the final. But who knows how it transfers out to the real
the
world.
The student does well in the final. I guess that's all you can say. That's spoken like a good scientist.
Man, my brother could teach skepticism.
We have a lot
you
of
could
calls.
You just ask them at the end, do you believe in horoscopes, right? Because horoscopes are a great example of confirmation
exactly,
bias.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, when it fits, you believe more, and when you forget when it doesn't fit. Yeah.
We are taking calls today only on topic. So if you want to talk about scientific method, if you want to talk about confirmation bias and some of these ideas, you want to ask more questions of Dominic Massaro, Professor Dominic Massaro, you're welcome to call in and get on air and ask us. The numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Next week, we'll take computer calls again and general tech calls again. So we were talking about double-blind studies a while ago, and especially through our email chat system. Somebody asked about it. And the double-blind is to try to remove as much human flaws from the scientific method. Can you explain a double-blind test for us?
That's
it. That's so hard.
Basically, you need control groups. So, for example, there was a study done of a particular pharmaceutical that would overcome schizophrenia. And so they had 8 or 10 schizophrenics. And sure enough, each of them got injected with this and improved their behavior. You know, the hallucinations went away and so on. So the experimenters were, of course, convinced, but in fact, they didn't have a control group, right? You have to inject people with an innocuous solution and see if they have the same
kind of
thing.
If you take a schizophrenic and you inject them with stuff and you say, this is going to make you better, amazingly, they get better.
That's what the pharmaceutical industry faces in terms of getting something approved by the FDA, because we know the placebo effect.
Right.
So if you tell a depressive that this is going to help them, then you get about a 30% improvement. So for the real thing to work, it's got to be like a 60% improvement.
But isn't an improvement an improvement? I mean, even if somebody gave me something and they said, this is really going to make you feel better, and I took it, believing it, and I felt better.
But that's the idea behind a lot of doctors who dole out homeopathy, is that there is no
right.
You know,
and remember, Miles is the one that said to everybody. So, but
yes,
you're right.
Yes, you can target Miles for his criticism of homeopathy.
The comment was from Miles.
Lot of doctors have that strategy of take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning, because you know the idea is that
you don't really need to do much.
That's right. Yeah.
So I'll explain the double blind study. The general concept is if you get a group of people and you actually tell them whether they're taking a medicine or not taking medicine, you actually give them information, it's not going to work.
That's
so you have to hide it from the patient.
Right.
That's a single blind. You hide it from the patient. They don't know what's going on.
Right.
Then I'm actually running the test. If I know, I'm going to interact with the patient differently, and therefore I might infer my bias to them, or I might take the study information from them a little differently. I might take their wording and kind of phrase it that, you know, instead of a 1 out of 10 pain threshold, whether it being an 8, I might make it a 7 because I know they're actually on the pill that is working.
Here, drink this.
I have to be blind as well. I have to not know if I'm giving.
The experimenter has to be blind, too.
And that's the double, the patient and the experimenter.
Yeah, so Rosenthal, a psychologist, did a lot of studies. He would get students as experimenters. And he would suggest to them what the results might look like. And sure enough, their results came in looking like what he suggested to them, even though with the different students, he would suggest different results. But again, in those cases, usually the results are somewhat ambiguous and you can push them either way. If you have a real strong result, that kind of bias probably isn't going to have that much of an influence, but it's a good thing to guard against.
All right. Let's take a call from Santa Cruz. Krishna, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Darling, can you turn on the radio now? Hello.
Hello. Welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your question?
Well, I woke up this morning mulling on this question about skepticism, which is my favorite thing to mull about.
Uh-huh.
And I remember being in school and listening to the folks in the Dark Ages when they thought that the Earth was the center of the universe and the sun revolved around it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason given was that in a way, we are so ethnocentric, that man is so important that everything revolves around him and it can affect everything. And I bring this question, of course, to this, that we have not lost that sense of us being so important, being able to affect the universe. And I bring this, of course, to global warming and how it is man-made. And then I listen to the doctor speaking. I think he's a doctor, right? Psychology?
Yes, PhD, and, yeah. I can't help your back problems, though.
No. And then I think about what happened in East Anglia and cooking data and only seeing or wanting to see so badly that which...
which confirms what they think.
Confirms right. what yeah. you believe in.
Yeah.
And skepticism... I think that we should be imbued with skepticism about everything. Mm-hmm. Because as far as global warming goes, which is perfectly natural and normal, but to inject ourselves into it and say that we are the cause of it.
Well, there is a general principle in science that, especially in astronomy, if you see something that looks unique to where you are, you're probably wrong. Like the general idea being that we're not different. Where we are in the universe is not different than anywhere else in the universe. That's the, right. one of the general concepts, right? So, but the thing is, and that's a pretty good way to start looking at stuff. But also, you could say, if we dump a whole bunch of oil off the coast and a whole bunch of birds die, and it's like a very giant catastrophe, we could say, well, this is not unique to us. We're not creating this. We're not unique. But the truth is that we did do that, right? So there's definitely a line there whether humans cause something or not. You can assume on large scales most of the time that humans don't have a large impact, but at some scales they do.
I am simply so impressed by the fact that human beings take themselves to be so important and all important that they can actually infect the way the universe works. And well, I find that amazing that hasn't been chopped up. This strength and this belief in ourselves.
We're an egotistic
species. And what we do will affect
species.
The universe.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Okay. It's a philosophical question for people on the left.
It is? And, Miles?
I was actually thinking she was saying we should imbue ourselves with this skepticism. And at the same time, I'm thinking as human beings, we have to consciously assert it because we're not logic engines. We're pattern matchers.
Right.
That's one of the problems, we find patterns.
And that's why it's important that science be a community enterprise, that the community exists to keep everybody honest. So we can't expect just to keep ourselves honest, but
it's got to have transparency. And that's this, when we talk about, publishing a peer-reviewed thing, the peer review is like a crucial step. You don't do that, you're just following a person.
But, really, the point that I think I pulled out of her was that she was saying, in the Dark Ages, we thought this way, and we thought how ridiculous that was. But she was saying, we're still that way.
To some degree, we are.
And we're still being the same way. It's just we're hiding it more.
We're still a human species.
We're still the center of the universe.
Well, here's another perspective to think on, like, the global warming issue, which I do believe is a partially man-made issue. It's not hurting the planet. It's going to hurt us.
Us. The planet will be better in a billion years.
Sure.
Come right back.
A million years, no big deal.
Right.
So in a big sense, it has no meaning at all to Earth.
Right.
You might lose some species and stuff. But again, evolution, that happens all the time anyway. Mm-hmm. So in a big sense, it's not a big deal. We just think of it as that way because we like our lifestyle. If you want to just let go of our lifestyle and billions of people will die and stuff, don't have to do anything about it. The Earth will correct itself. No big deal. From Moss Landing, Bruce, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yes, hi. Just in listening to the comments, Roz, very much, especially when you're talking about Nature magazine and so forth, that there's very much a sociological aspect in terms of peer acceptance and wanting to be part of the group and discounting things that don't fall within the group's structural beliefs, much like recently with the situation with ulcers with having a bacterial causality, and yet it was an Australian MD, which was far outside of the normal scientific circles, and so was immediately discounted for 2 decades, basically. Now something that's widely accepted, but you get that aspect of it where the cultural belief system then gets inculcated on top of the person's belief system, and they may not even realize it's happening. And I think the other aspect of it that's interesting is just that you mentioned global warming is that we look at everything in terms of our perspective of time. So something that happens within a human time frame is something that we can grasp. Something like earthquakes or climate change that that may happen once in a lifetime, something that we can't grasp, and we're using our own time frames, so that even in Santa Cruz, where we have an earthquake every 50 years, in geologic time, that's almost like seconds apart if we looked at that on a human scale. But we can't grasp that. I mean, it's something right. that goes outside of our normal frame of reference.
Well, thanks, Bruce, for the call and the comment. So how do we guard against this? How do we guard against this idea that people in general have this idea and therefore everything they do kind of supports that idea, especially in science? It seems like it's a really bad thing.
So how do you guard against confirmation bias? So one thing that requires a little restructuring of our needs is that maybe we should just take pleasure in being wrong. There's nothing wrong with being wrong. You know, John Holt says that he goes in to a group of kids and says, you know, think of a number between 1 in 1,000, and someone says, is it between 1 in 500? And if he says yes, everybody claps. If he says no, everybody's real sad. But you learn just as much in those two cases. So that's great fun. So, you know, the delight in being wrong, you know.
That is true. My mother-in-law, she was getting her PhD in molecular genetics, and she worked on this project for a really long time. It seemed like years. And it ended up that the gene she was working on didn't suppress cancer tumors. But even that, you would think, oh, what a failure. But really, no, that's not a failure, because she's confirmed that this gene does not do what they were supposing. So even being wrong is valuable information. You know, people always want to come out with a big thing, but, you know, information.
It's small steps.
Yeah.
Grows on itself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any more on that?
So that's why having don't settle on just believing in one hypothesis. So I like fuzzy logic, where a proposition isn't just true or false, but true to some degree. So we might say, you know, theory of evolution is maybe true to degree 0.97. You know, just allow that it might still be falsified.
Right.
And so that kind of thing.
Yeah, I forgot who said it, but there was someone in the past who made the quote that the greatest discoveries were not followed by a loud eureka, but rather a more circumscript, that's funny.
Right. Yeah, that's a good one, yeah.
You can learn a lot more about what Dominic Massaro does at his website, which is linked from geekspeak.org. Dom's professor, PhD. He's a professor of psychology and of computer engineering and lots of other things at UCS. He's been around for a while. And he's got a great website that talks a lot about the different work he does. All his books are available up there, so you can buy those. You've got a couple hundred books. Dom, thank you for coming down here to be on
Geeks. It's been a great
Speak
pleasure being with the Geeks. Great.
We'll have to have you on again. It was clearly a wonderful experience. In just a minute, we're going to play the USB of the week, and we'll probably have a little bit of chatting after that as well. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Wait, Don't Tell Me is a weekly hour-long radio quiz program. Each week on the radio, you can test your knowledge and get some of the best and brightest in the news and entertainment world while figuring out what's real news and what's made up. On the web, you can play along too. That's Wait, Don't Tell Me, today at noon on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
Hi, Al.
Hi, happy holidays.
Can I talk to you about something?
Sure, what's up?
Well, it's about that drumming music thing.
Oh, you must mean my USB drumming Santa Claus with flashing blue LED lights. His little drumming hands go along with the beat.
Yeah, well, it's been going for a few hours now, and it's getting kind of annoying. You think maybe you could cool it with the drumming Santa for a while?
Oh, I'm sorry, Miss Scrooge. Why don't we just cancel Christmas, too?
No, really. I know you like all these USB devices, but it's really hard to think with that thing on.
Sure. Just kidding. No problem. I'll unplug my USB drumming Santa Claus with flashing LED lights and 104-centimeter USB cable.
Thanks, Al.
Yep. No problem. Santa is put away. Of course, there's always the USB drumming snowman with flashing blue LED lights with his little hands keeping the beat. Happy holidays, everyone. Links on geekspeak.org.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark online tonight with David Lawrence. He's used with permission. The Geeks today were Ben Jaffe from Berkeley from his home via Skype, and Al Luckow and Miles Elam. Geeks, thanks.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And our guest was Dom Massaro. Dominic Massaro is professor of psychology from UCSC. Dom, thank you very much. Car Talk is next on KUSP, and it's made possible from a grant from the Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County. We appreciate their support for GeekSpeak and KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell, and we'll be here next week, as we are every week. And next week, we'll take tech calls, I promise. Of course, you can learn more about us at geekspeak.org, including a great video of our parade episode last week, which was a lot of fun in downtown Santa Cruz. See you next week, and here comes Car Talk.